are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, January 29th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Reniqua Allen on her book, It Was All a Dream, A New Generation Confronts the Broken Promise to Black America. Also on the program today, Whitaker claims that Mueller is almost done, and he'll do the reviewing of the report, thank you. Nancy Pelosi says that Trump can do the State of the Union address next week. Senate advances a bill making it illegal to boycott Israeli products. Sure. In the House, Ro Khanna plans to reintroduce the War Powers Resolution on Yemen. And Republican leaders in the Senate think an estate tax repeal is a winner. Shutdown, meanwhile, still having painful effects. And John Bolton's dumb games could get a lot of people killed. New report shows the tax cuts a failure even on their own terms. Well, depends on if you believe the terms we were given. And Trump's EPA passes on water testing requirements for deadly chemicals in our drinking water. So, if you got a problem with the tax cuts, just drink enough water and it'll all go away.
That always works itself out.
Denver students march in solidarity with their teachers as Virginia teachers march yesterday and West Virginia teachers vote for a one-day work stoppage. Mitch McConnell's got a Russian oligarch money problem. And lastly, happy 2019, folks. The Supreme Court may effectively kill Roe v. Wade this week by doing nothing. All this and more on today's program. I'm going to get to, I will not leave the first half of the show before I tell you about this Supreme Court. Really, it'll be a non-decision that will effectively kill Roe v. Wade. This is not hyperbole. This is something that we've actually talked about, I think, multiple times over the past year or two, about the way it would go down. This could be one of those moments literally any minute now. And I'm frankly sort of shocked at the complete lack of coverage it's getting, but we'll see. I will explain at the end of the program, I should say the end of the free half here, because I think this is something that everybody should know about. We'll talk about it after the guest. I don't know why I feel obligated to read this email, but I do, just to show that as much as we have a problem with math around here, that we can bring the country together in the spirit of bipartisanship. Hello, Sam et al. Maybe it was that. Just I appreciate people using the ETAL. Moniker. I know how you all feel about math, but it's like science in that it doesn't give two shits about how you feel about it. It just is, right? Math doesn't care about your feelings. Anyway, according to the show numbers in my Majority Report app, this Friday will be the 2019th Majority Report happening in the year of our Lord, 2019. This is a singular occurrence. No matter how many more Majority Report shows there ever are, there will never be a show number that matches the year. please consider the mathematical, numerological, astrological, and historical significance of a show number matching the current year. The odds of this happening are astronomical, but you and your intrepid crew have done it. Celebrate. Invite some serious math nerd on Friday and geek out. You know you want to. Yours for nearly 3 years now, and never asked for anything till now. Listener Pero. Look, I have some bad news for you. We have made an executive decision that after Friday, we are only going to number one show a year. So it will be 2019 will be the last numbered show for this year. And then we're going to do another one in January of 2020. So this will not be a singular occurrence. It's actually going to be repeated for years now.
Because it's so fun.
Because it's so fun.
I just like the idea that we would have let 2,000 episodes go by without even realizing it.
Right, but we're going to mark the 2019. This. So starting Monday, the show will go like this. It will be Monday will be the 2019th A show, and then 2019 B on Tuesday, 2019 C on Wednesday, et cetera, until we get down to Z. And then, of course, we will go back to 2019 AA will be the next show. 30 shows out or 24 shows out from Monday, and then 48 shows out, it'll be AAA, and so on.
It'll make sense.
We'll make it all the way to the 2020, and then we can just start over again.
That's some powerful numerology right there.
Yeah, so it's not that big of a deal. It is not singular. We have math may exist in the but it is we just showed how you can manipulate it. So
it kind of does care about your feelings.
It does. I didn't feel good about it. I ain't going to do it. Speaking of not feeling good, my daughter over the past couple of weeks had a horrible stomach virus. There was a lot of vomiting. And how did I deal with it? Well, it was painstaking. But what I did do, and I hope they don't mind me talking about this, because I guess you don't want to associate that with this, but I gave her a bunch of liquid IV because I was very concerned that she would get dehydrated. And it's very difficult to say to a kid, hey, drink a lot of water and have them do it. I mean, it's difficult to say to a kid, do anything and have them do it. But with 110% daily value of vitamin C and B12, liquid IV is a great way to stay healthy and hydrated during these cold winter months. Liquid IV is not your average electrolyte drink mix. It uses cellular transport technology in a specific ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium, which, when mixed with 16 ounces of water, helps your body absorb more water and nutrients directly into your bloodstream. It can provide the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. Liquid IV is the fastest growing hydration brand, and you can find them everywhere, even Costco, and you can find them all at Costco's nationwide. Like I say, I use this when I've been drinking a little bit too much. I use it when I'm feeling like I'm a little dehydrated, but was able to give some to Milo when I was worried that she was going to get dehydrated. I love Liquid IV. I know you will too. Right now, my listeners get 20% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Go to liquidiv.com, enter my promo code MAJORITY to get your savings and start getting better hydration. That's liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. And lastly, two more pieces of housekeeping. I was incredibly remiss. First off, this goes out to my buddy. Lawyer Matthew, happy birthday. A couple of days late. I apologize. And this, the royal fanfare to celebrate the birth of Ronald Reagan's, is a father again. They let him do it again. Sort of shocking. But he has a, my understanding is a very healthy daughter and mom and dad, sibling, all doing healthy and or well and healthy and excited to have there. So congratulations, sucker. Did not listen to me. Did not listen to me. All right. I have a feeling this is going to be the last time we're talking about this guy, because I don't think I've ever seen anybody so quickly, so thoroughly humiliated in so many venues by so many different people. There is really, I mean, this is...
It's like doing a Sam Nunberg.
It's more than that. It's more than that, because there's no pity. And there's not even, like, there's not even the same, like, sort of joie de vivre in this. This is just feels like everybody's doing their job, right? Everybody. And that job, of course, is to make Howard Schultz, the billionaire owner of a series of cafes, coffee shops, or formerly, that he doesn't get to be king just because he's so rich. He can go around and be unofficial king, as a lot of these billionaires are doing, but he doesn't get to be named king. Sorry. And here he is with Andrew Ross Sorkin. Is that who it is? Does Andrew Ross Sorkin... Does he live in one of like Howard Schultz's like suit coat pockets? Does he just hang out there?
He's a billionaire whisperer.
Yeah. Yeah. He just sort of pals around with him. And here he is interviewing him at Barnes & Noble. This is in New York City, correct? And CNN was did they cover this live, or is this, they videotaped it? Like they do all events at Barnes & Noble. And for people who nobody knew who this guy was 3 weeks ago. And talk about, if this was his plan to sell books, I got some bad news for you, buddy. Here we go.
I am seriously considering running for president as a centrist independent. And I wanted to clarify the word independent, which I view merely as a designation on the ballot.
And don't help elect Trump, you egotistical billionaire.
I love Aaron Ross Sorkin's look on his face when he's just like, really upset. Now, so there was that heckler. That was highly inappropriate. And so he came back, another one came back for a more appropriate one. Same guy.
Don't help elect Trump, you egotistical billionaire. Go back to getting ratioed on Twitter. Go back to Davos with the other billionaire elite who think they know how to run the world. That's not what democracy means.
We're going to get to that idea and that sentiment in just a minute.
There you go. That was awesome.
They're going to keep trying to do this, though.
Well, what do you mean? They're going to keep trying to do what? Who is they?
Egotistical billionaire centrists who represent that point of view.
The most amazing thing about this was yesterday when Michael Bloomberg basically said, like, hey, I swallowed enough of my pride to not do this. Like my therapy worked for a long time for me just get to the place where I wasn't just so narcissistic that I thought I could do this. I am richer than you. And if anybody should have done it, it should have been me, and you cannot do it.
Yeah. If there's one thing billionaires hate, it's other billionaires taking liberties that they themselves didn't take.
Right. And he's like, I was big enough, man. Like if there's any billionaire who deserved to be king, it would have been me. And since I was big enough to not take it, it is absurd that you would even think about taking it. In fact, it's a personal offense to me. That's what Bloomberg is saying. That's so awesome. But this guy is, this is where was he? Let's just listen to this a little bit. He was on NPR Morning Edition, right? This guy's like, put aside for a moment that he's that the whole concept is obnoxious and offensive. Put aside the incredible narcissism, the sense of propriety, the sort of like the complete obliviousness. This guy's also really bad at this. and seems to have just like, I'll tell you what this is an example of. This is an example of a guy who has had no one question anything out of his mouth for years. Nothing. He's showing up on all these shows with like not even one quarter baked ideas about what he's doing. This is a guy who has been so encased in amber in terms of like criticism or even the questioning.
Well, he's used to getting ratioed on Twitter.
I mean, but you don't think he looks at that, do you? You don't think he looks at the replies. He has somebody who brings him a form that says, you got this many replies. Oh, great. He doesn't know what ratio means.
I don't know. I think he's mad that people are allowed to tweet at him.
He probably doesn't. He's probably just so far removed. And it's stunning because he's completely unprepared for this. And he's getting softball questions virtually from everywhere.
Shareholder value had to be balanced and equaled with creating value for our customers and, most importantly, for our people.
Would you be changing as president laws or pushing to change SEC regulations, anything else to change the business environment in which shareholder value has become utterly paramount for companies across this country?
I don't think I would be changing laws, but what I would try and do is influence public CEOs to understand that we have a moral obligation and responsibility not only to make a profit and create shareholder value, but also to do everything we can to do more for our employees and the communities we serve.
Pause it. Now, why would you need to be president to do that? Right? He's like, I'm not going to use any part of government to in any way infringe or mitigate the horridness of shareholder value concept of the way that companies should be measured. I'm just going to do it from the bully pulpit. But here's a guy with billions of dollars. He could spend $300 million and he'd be on so many ads across the country saying this that we would know every contour of his face. We'd be able to count how many hairs are on his head with the amount of money that he would spend in the same way that I would contemplate, like, we're going to go out for a good company dinner. But he needs to be president to do this, apparently. But no laws.
Serve.
Can you preach your way to that change on a large scale in a system where a CEO who doesn't maximize shareholder value can get sued or lose the company?
Financial performance, in a way, is the price of admission. A company has to perform. But you don't have to perform at the expense of your people.
What Schultz has not made clear, at this early stage at least, is how, if at all, he would change the economic or political systems under which he grew rich. It is not clear how he would reduce the national debt, although he says it is far too high. He says Republicans fail to take it seriously, and he accuses Democrats of making promises that could enlarge it.
Free Medicare for all, government-paid free college for all. First of all, there's no free. I mean, nothing is free.
President Obama's theory was that you reduce the deficit in small measure by raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans. President Trump's theory was that you reduce the deficit by cutting taxes on the wealthiest Americans. You're smiling. Which, if either of those, is true?
Look, can I say it in my own words?
Please.
So we are in dire need of comprehensive tax reform, which would include a significant level of infrastructure development.
Is it safe to say that the wealthiest would have to pay more, whatever the rates become, however the reform is structured?
What I would say is that we need comprehensive tax reform.
Oh, my God.
Why do you stick with that particular phrase?
Because I think there are a number of areas here that need to be addressed. And I'm not trying to dodge any question. I feel like, you know, what we have today is an unfair system. However, when I see Elizabeth Warren
pause it for a second.
Come
okay.
out with...
Yeah, I got news for you. He is trying to dodge a question. When you say, I'm not trying to dodge a question, and everybody thinks you're dodging a question, guess what? You're dodging the question. Either taxes are going to go up on the wealthy or they're going to go down. If you just change, you know, well, they pay $30 worth of taxes on $100, but what we're going to do is we're going to splice that up. And what they're going to end up doing is paying $15 of taxes on $50. And that's the way that we are. That's the comprehensive reform that we're talking about. Well, I mean, do they end up paying more or less? I'm going to avoid that question in my own language. But let me take the opportunity to criticize Elizabeth Warren.
However, when I see Elizabeth Warren come out with, you know, a ridiculous plan of taxing wealthy people, a surtax of 2% because it makes a good headline or sends out a tweet, when she knows for in a fact that's not something that's ever going to be passed, this is what's wrong. I mean, you can't just attack these things in a punitive way by punishing people.
But I'm just thinking, you've got $1 trillion annual deficits now in good times. Getting that down calls for some specific painful-sounding things. Drastic cut in military spending at a time when the United States is confronting China and Russia and who knows who else. Changes to Medicare and Social Security. Tax increases on somebody. Are you going to do that?
Well, you haven't talked about growth.
So, you think you can grow your way out of $1 trillion?
I don't think you can. No. I don't think you can grow your way out of $1 trillion. But I remember, I've been an entrepreneur for the last 40 years. I view things a little bit differently than certainly a traditional politician. And I have a 30-year-plus record of being able to solve complex problems in unique ways.
Though he is vague about what he would do if elected, Howard Schultz is insistent that he can be an alternative in the presidential campaign.
I can't think of anything that is a more quintessential expression of our democracy than providing the American people with a choice
for president.
That doesn't have to be binary between a Republican and Democrat.
He says the next president must be the right person, and he will decide within months if he thinks that person should be him.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Why does this guy even get to be interviewed on NPR?
That's,
like, what the
that's
hell?
That's what I was saying about he was on 60 Minutes yesterday, too.
Like, how long did it take for them to give Bernie a serious interview last time around?
It is stunning. He just bought his way onto these places and is talking about democracy demands that he, that some wealthy guy run as an independent. It's shocking. It's shocking. The level of delusion. And some people speculated that this was basically a shot across the bow, threatening, you know, if you nominate Elizabeth Warren, if you nominate Bernie Sanders, this is what's going to happen. But Mike Bloomberg came out and said, no, you will not.
I think to update the libertarian challenge, we should do a billionaire debate challenge, too. Like, people like Howard Schultz want to call in and debate us.
Yes, I will do right now. This is a message I'm sending out to Howard Schultz. Debate me. I insist. You come on this program. You can call in. And if you want, you can fly in. You can fly in and you can. I'll let you sit in this seat. I'll sit over there and you can sit here.
It builds so much character for him, I think, being surrounded by yes men all the time.
I think democracy calls for it. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking to Reniqua Allen on her book, It Was All a Dream, A New Generation Confronts a Broken Promise to Black America. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program producer with Fork Films and author of It Was All a Dream, A New Generation Confronts the Broken Promise to Black America. Reniqua Allen, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Sam.
So let's start with why. Why did you set out to write this book, which was, I guess, basically an examination in many respects of the millennials, black millennials' response to, you'll tell us from your perspective, but a perpetual frustration that black people have in this country.
Absolutely. I saw stories of the millennial generation, which, as you may know, is not doing too well overall. There are lots of stories, particularly about kind of these urban elites, overeducated, entitled folks. But what I felt was missing from the conversation was actually a story about people of color, and particularly young black people like myself. I saw my story feeling a little bit different. Yeah, absolutely, like kind of a millennial story. But race makes everything look a little bit different. I felt like things like, discrimination and racism and the burdens that carry was being missed on the story of the millennial. So I wanted to change that and talk to people, and not just myself, because I get tired of listening to myself. But I wanted to talk to other people and hear what they were going through too, and the things that they were experiencing. So that's why I started to write the book.
And you ended up interviewing about 75 people across the country. Tell us how you found them.
Yeah, in a range of ways. Some of the stories about millennials are out there. So there were a few that I were interested in, but I kind of looked at what the traditional notions of success were in America, what opportunity looked like, and then started kind of, then the things are pretty common: housing, education, student debt, and reached out to some organizations. As I talked more to people about this book, some people contacted me with friends or family, some stories I found in newspaper articles. So really a range of ways that I reached out to people and decided who I wanted to profile.
And the title of the book, It Was All a Dream, comes from a Biggie Smalls song. Why that title? I mean, at what point did that title come in for you, I guess?
I think the title was actually where I started. I mean, I knew I wanted to talk about opportunity in Black America, and I wanted to talk about opportunity in young Black America. And somehow, initially the conversations were about the American dream and what that meant. And I think I was just listening to the music. I listened to a lot of music, and the title of the song Juicy came up, and this idea, this notion of dreams was really in my mind, and it kind of came from there pretty organically. But I mean, I was also interested in how the notion of the dream in the Black community, obviously thinking about Martin Luther King's dream, and how that has kind of changed and morphed for different generations, and how, I think Biggie's song is actually a play on MLK's lyric, MLK's speech, and how even Jay-Z, even after Biggie died, kind of said, was it all a dream? And how we're kind of, I think, as a Black community, constantly thinking about dreams and promises, and really systematically, I think, being denied it, not just systematically, but culturally as well, being denied these dreams and promises and what that meant to us.
Has that, because Juicy is optimistic, I think, as a song, right? I mean, and so has the perspective, or I guess let me ask you this and then I want to get into maybe some of the individuals, but I'm curious as to what, let's start with overall, what your experience is of Black millennials what their response, what their perspective is on the American dream, how you, you know, might imagine it's different from white millennials in terms of what they experience. And then we'll, I want to talk about maybe what that, how that relationship to the American dream has changed, or if it has changed at all, in earlier, from earlier Black generations.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, one of the most surprising statistics I found pretty early on when it relates to the American dream was that Black millennials, more than anyone in this generational cohort, actually believe in the American dream the most. Now, when you look at the studies, it's actually young white people who say that they've achieved it the most, but young Black people actually believed in it. They're optimistic. I think we are optimistic as a people, and I think that partially because we have like no other choice to be but optimistic. I think, you know, America's been pretty crappy to Black people. To be young in Black America doesn't always feel safe. I mean, there's a group of young women in New York State that that just was searched, you know, for their clothes. We see countless video after video of young Black men and women being brutalized, terrorized, and even killed by law enforcement. We know that, you know, it's not always safe place to be. America is not always a safe place to be. However, I say that with a caveat because I do think there's a lot of joy. There's a lot of optimism. There was, you know, high political rates of participation, of a political participation in the Black community. So I think that like these are all really wonderful things. And I say that, but also I think that there's still a desire to be seen as human, to be not seen as, you know, a burden or a problem. And I think that, you know, every single Black millennial I talk to, despite, you know, sexuality or political affiliation, or, you know, class position, said that race, their race impacted their lives. I think that that matters. And I think when you look at white millennials, for example, and I should say Black and millennials of color doesn't necessarily mean they have equal experiences, but particularly when you look at white millennials, I think that sometimes they don't have to worry about those things. They don't have to worry about things like, am I going to get home safely? Now, they're worried and equally is burdened, I think, by some of the things that the millennial generation overall faces, like, you know, student debt, for example, or, you know, home ownership. But I think that because they don't have to contend with some of the other forces like racism and discrimination, their dreams are, you know, a little bit different. I think that for Black millennials, you know, they still want to not be, they want to be visible. You know, they want, you know, we're the only group that has had to say our lives mattered. And that's a pretty significant thing for me, what that does to a person. You know, having a Black president, people don't necessarily think cured issues around race or racism. So it's a unique space to be. But at the same time, I think a lot of our dreams, the fundamental dreams, you know, still center around, you know, home ownership, housing. But we also want to be free. And I think that we don't necessarily think that. And white millennials don't have to worry about that.
Where do you think it lies? I mean, and I think like the you know, you write about buying a house, and I guess in 2005, and subsequent to that, finding that you were eligible for participation in a class action because the mortgage your lender was involved in predatory practices, and I think. You know, the idea that Black Americans were targeted more with these predatory practices is a function of there being, in addition to there being sort of broadly speaking less wealth in the Black community because of less opportunity to develop wealth over time, but also less opportunities to borrow, and so going in and getting a a supposed subprime loan, or at least those type of terms, when you maybe you didn't need to actually. Had you been white, or had not been sort of cajoled into this? I'm not saying you specifically. I'm talking about the community.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I wonder, to the extent that we're talking about, Black Lives Matter, and to what extent is the relationship between these fears, are they being, is the difference for millennials that there is a theoretically greater awareness, broad-based awareness of what Black Americans go through in terms of, particularly in the context of police and this concept, because of just like video cameras? I mean, within the Black community, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine there's been, a Gen X, baby boomers, they were all, those generations were all aware that, like, look, you're going to get treated differently. You're telling your kids you're going to get treated differently. You got to be careful out there. I imagine that's, that's not new. The newness is that there's almost, there's an ability to show it to a broader audience.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. However, I'll say that I think that in the millennial generation, really, and I'm in the next generation, Gen Z will see it too, we had to do this with the understanding that we were in the kind of shadow of the civil rights movement, right? Jesse Jackson had run for president. We saw Barack Obama. Most millennials came of age as Barack Obama was elected, to the White House, I think. And we are the most diverse adult generation now. Gen Z just took us over, I think, being the most diverse population, but we are the most diverse adult population. I think that so many of us, or a lot of us, grew up even seeing, with white or partners of other colors. Schools are largely segregated now, but, a lot of us have had friends of other colors and other races. There are lots of Black representation on television. Right? Oprah was coming to dominate as we were growing up. So I think that there is this message that, well, if Issa Rae can do it, so can you. If Barack Obama can do it, you guys just work harder. But there aren't, there aren't limitations. I mean, even Donald Trump, and this was, I think, the 90s, said that he'd want to be a well-educated Black because they have lots of opportunities. So there's this language of opportunity is out there, and race doesn't matter, right? When Obama was, after he was elected, there's all this talk of like a post-racial America. So there's, there's not, and even, and I should say, even, I'm not sure if you've read it, but even as recently as, I don't know, but last week or 2 weeks ago, there was an article in out of a Boston outlet that said MLK's dream of racism, has largely, been achieved, which is like, what? So I think that, we have it a bit, it's a different place. It's essentially the same story, but I think we grew up in a different place than Gen X and definitely the baby boomer. So that makes our experiences unique. I don't want to say better or worse, but unique.
I just want to tease that out a little bit more. Like what is it? Is it more complicated in some ways, in that it's not as, if you're fighting for the right to vote, you're fighting for the right to not be discriminated when you go into a restaurant. If you're fighting for the right to not be discriminated in housing, it's a fairly binary, straightforward thing. But if you're, if you ostensibly have those rights, but the options are limited, and in the context of a generation like the millennials, where they don't have the same opportunities that we did in Gen X, and those people who are who have the least political power, broadly speaking, who are subject to racism, are going to be even more impacted by the dynamics that are impacting the millennials, broadly speaking. Is that in some ways, I mean, I don't, you know, it's not a competition, but and I can tell that it's, you know, obviously it's unique, but I'm curious as to that dynamic. That is sort of the problems are more subtle in some respects than, you know, somebody turning a fire hose on you.
Right. Yeah, that's like, I find the frustration of this generation. Now, there are lots of things that aren't so subtle, right? Like, you know, we are seeing black and brown men gunned down on cell phones, right? That is not subtle. We see the language that's used even around, well, you know, sometimes the language can be their dog whistles, right? Sometimes that can be subtle and not so subtle. But I absolutely think that, and from the millennials that I spoke with, said that was the most frustrating part about this generation, about feeling less than, but having to prove that you experience some kind of racism in a way that, you know, people want you to say, well, did someone call you the N-word? Because that, you know, that to people proves that racism still exists. But what I think is harder for people is for someone to say, oh, here's this mediocre woman who just got promoted over me, and I think it's race, but I can't quite tell. I'm not sure. Or someone saying, you know, a friend of mine who's a C student, you know, has a great job. Her dad is, you know, a VP of a company. You know, that's why, you know, she had this network, but, you know, I didn't have that. And people seeing that as, you know, a problem of race, and things like affirmative action not being advocated for as much. Someone, you know, being asked for the ID at a polling place, is it race, is it not? Like, you know, I feel like a lot of young millennials are kind of playing this game and don't always know how to deal with that, but still ultimately feeling that they are less than, that their lives actually are, you know, worth less, that they aren't seen as equal. And that's a frustrating place to be in.
To what extent, in your experience, are black millennials sensitive to race? I mean, excuse me, to class?
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, it's interesting dynamic, and I think we're going to see it, you know, play out, you know, more and more in these elections, because the African American vote was the older vote seemed to go, at least within the context of like the Democratic primary anyways, seemed to go with Clinton. Younger votes seemed to go with Sanders. We're going to get another opportunity, I think, in some respects during this primary to see how that shakes out. I'm curious, where does class figure in with black millennials?
Oh, that's a great question. I think class is absolutely it's huge. I have two chapters, one specifically focused on black professionals and one focused on working class millennials. And it plays a huge role in their lives. I actually found that Ellis Coast did a study on black middle class folks in the 90s. And he said that it was a rage of a privileged class. And I found the most actually frustration, I think, with middle class or upper income black millennials. And I think it's because, and this is kind of the same conclusion that Coase came to earlier on, that they have more of a proximity to white people. They are in corporate spaces more. They feel like they're tested by the system, quote unquote, even more so. And they were frustrated, you know, by all means. Every single person I spoke with for this chapter in this group had made it. They were professional, but they felt like they were always questioned, and they felt like twice as hard was a very, very real thing for them that they experienced every single day. And it was a real, I would say, even burden on their lives. And it also impacted their lives in other ways that were interesting to me. Like, I started a lot of reporting for this book during the height of the Black Lives Matter movement, and they felt that as Black professionals, they sometimes couldn't even protest or speak out in the ways that some of their counterparts could. So that impacted the way in their decisions on how to be vocal. So that was also interesting. And a lot of them thought of the class divide because they thought that they had more on the line. So that was really interesting. And yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm curious. I mean, if I understand what you're saying, that there was the wealthier and I guess in terms of, you know, compensation or in terms of making money, the more successful folks you spoke to, they more acutely felt the impact of their race. Is that what you're saying?
I think they felt that in the context of the workplace more, because often these were folks who were the only one or one of a few. They felt directly that they had to kind of deal with this microaggressions every day. And I think more than any other group, they struggled with kind of, as you mentioned earlier, what is this subtle racial innuendo? How do I deal with that? And what are the consequences and repercussions for that?
That's interesting. And why is that? Just simply because they're the world in which they work in is just more white, and
yes.
And they're being judged constantly by white people.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, it kind of goes across industry, right? Largely white folks are the ones in power, whatever you're generally talking about, but particularly in these corporate spaces, in these professional environments, they didn't feel like, you know, even the ones with good positions with, you know, a lot of power still didn't feel like they had the autonomy. They still didn't feel like they had the freedom, so to speak, as their white counterparts to just kind of be.
Were there any particular people or stories that you met? I mean, characters who stuck out for you as you met these 75 people that stick with you today?
Yeah, there was one. So I wanted to look at opportunity and how people were successful and what even success meant in a broad range of ways and how they were approaching that. And one way that I was interested in was sex work. Wanted to see if that, you know, what was going on in that industry and for young millennials, and talked to a bunch of sex workers in Chicago. And actually two stories there. One of a dominatrix who was working to literally pay for her master's degree. Her parents had cut her off, actually, because they didn't agree with her wanting to pursue gender studies. And she, you know, had some loans, but it wasn't enough. So ended up becoming a dominatrix. And actually, as she said, still was being charged. She could still only charge with so much. She couldn't charge the same as her white counterparts.
Hmm.
Because of, you know, just discrimination, like, you know, she was making a third of, right, of what they were making. But also she talked about how her largely white clientele, and she felt conflicted about this because she felt like, you know, people liked her dark skin and her clientele was largely white men, and how she would whip them while also espousing like Black feminist ideology and how it was very cathartic for her to kind of crack the whip on what she says were, you know,
CEOs,
largely racist people. Yeah, it was kind of, yeah, she had a class analysis where she did, you know, she didn't like how, you know, their class position and was frustrated with that. And also, you know, they just were not woke, and I would say that, so to speak. But it's interesting that she said that was a way of healing for her. I thought that was just fascinating. She was a completely fascinating person, and that story just kind of blew my mind.
It's also stunning that she's getting she's that sort of conscious also of not getting the market rate.
Because
it sounds like some of those clientele were specifically, you know, they were looking for I think rates was obviously playing a big part in what they were looking to in terms of their catharsis as well. Who else struck you? I mean, there was a character from Ohio, Michael, whose story was pretty. Yeah. I mean, that's not his real name, but tell us about him as well.
Yeah, I know. He was another one who was fascinating because I set out to talk about student debt, right? Because that is a millennial experience. I think Gen X started, you know, to experience that, but millennials really have seen tuition rates climb. And I was trying to figure out like what the role of education was in terms of mobility. So I met this young man who had a stunning amount of student debt. But his story was more complicated than just being someone who took out a lot of money for college. He actually went to school on an athletic scholarship and was injured. I had no idea that those scholarships aren't necessarily for 4 years. Now, there's some groups advocating for that to be changed for right. You to be able to have multi-year scholarships. But once he was injured, he wanted to pursue his education and had to do his best to figure out how to do so. Now, he also came from, he didn't come from, like, you know, so to speak, of poverty. His dad had a kind of good working class job, but because of where we are and what's happening to the working class and industrialization, his dad had to retire early. So he was, you know, his factory closed. And so he couldn't, you know, assist his son with college after he lost his, after he lost the scholarship. And his story kind of spiraled as he was just trying to constantly play catch up after losing the scholarship, you know, figuring out how to deal with healthcare and trying to take kind of jobs here and there running for student government. He's quite a charismatic young man, but also said he felt a difference of not having the security that some of his peers did, of not being able to ask his parents for significant amounts right. of money and trying to really contend with that and still kind of remarkably going to school, going through school. And then, you know, he wanted to get a master's degree despite having this kind of staggering amount of $100,000 of debt. He was continuing on because he felt that this was his dream.
All right. So lastly, I mean, when you entered it, what do you think, how did your perspective, or did you go through any like major change in perspective on, I guess, millennials or yourself in the context of this, I guess, study of folks?
Yeah, I think it was more depressing than I realized about how young Black people really feel marginalized in America, how they feel invisible. A lot of people, including that young man I just spoke about, Michael, was feeling depressed. A lot of people were suicidal. It was a hard thing to feel like you are constantly told you are less than. They felt like they were still treated that way. However, I think the amazing thing was that so many young people were persisting. They were determined to make their own way. They were determined to push back, and that was wonderful and amazing. And that feels like, you know, what Black people have been doing for years, but also what millennials are doing. They were entrepreneurs. They were having side hustles. They were optimistic, and that was kind of amazing to me. I was blown away by that.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Reniqua Allen, the book is It Was All a Dream, A New Generation Confronts the Broken Promise to Black America. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. Oh, but before we do, I want to talk about this this case that I think we're going to know within a day or two if essentially Roe v. Wade is done, is inoperative in this country. And what I mean by that, let me just be clear from the get-go. Right now, there is a federal right, one that the Supreme Court has determined is embedded in our Constitution for women to receive an abortion. And it is an important enough right that it cannot be infringed upon but at the highest standard of scrutiny. In other words, there can be some mitigation of that right, some infringement upon that right. In states, after a certain number of weeks, the state can outlaw abortion, except for in very narrow circumstances. But the most recent example of this scrutiny came in regard to a TRAP law, which is a short for Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers. In 2015, it was 2016, there was a Texas law that went to the Supreme Court. It was Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. This is a Texas law that basically said, specifically said, a physician performing or inducing an abortion at a clinic had to have active admitting privileges at a hospital that is not more than 30 miles away from where the abortion is performed. And that hospital needed to provide gynecological or obstetrical healthcare services. So if you're at a, and many times, physicians working at these clinics do not have admitting privileges at hospitals. Certainly not within 30 miles, but very often they just aren't affiliated with the hospital. They work for the clinic. May travel, depending on the state, they may travel around to various clinics and whatnot. This was a law that was set up specifically as like a bank shot to make it impossible for clinics to provide abortions to women. It's like also, you know, they have other laws like trap laws like this. Like the clinic must have 22-foot high ceilings. You know, things that are basically impossible to have happen in the real world. That decision, the Hellerstedt, was a 5-3 decision. Scalia was dead. There was eight justices on the court. And Kennedy added the fifth vote to the four liberals on the court. An identical law was passed by Louisiana. It went to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that court upheld the Louisiana law. Now, even one of the guys on the court, appointed by Reagan, wrote in the dissent that you all are ignoring the Supreme Court precedent. Circuit courts of appeal, they cannot ignore Supreme Court precedent. And this law, as written in Louisiana, was virtually identical, if not identical, to the Texas law. The Supreme Court struck it down. This Fifth Circuit could not find, without completely ignoring the Supreme Court, that this law was constitutional. So the way that this is resolved is the case heads up to the Supreme Court. The lawyers who are representing the abortion clinic and two of the physicians, presumably who work there, filed an application to the Supreme Court on Monday, yesterday, to halt this Louisiana law because they've already resolved this question. If the Supreme Court now, which is constituted very differently than it was in 2016, Kennedy is gone, Scalia's seat has been filled, there is a 5-4 majority, more than likely, to simply say, we're not going to address this. In other words, we have no problem with lower courts ignoring that precedent we set about trap laws. And if that's the case, every state in the country that is a red state and more are going to try, well, the red states are going to try and legislate something very similar. They'll probably just start with this. And then if that's not effective in eliminating abortion services in their state, they'll come up with another one. And Roe v. Wade, there's not going to be any announcement that Roe v. Wade is overturned, but Roe v. Wade is essentially no longer in effect. Now, this dynamic already exists to some degree around the country. You have, I think it's one or two states in the center of the country where there's maybe one abortion provider virtually impossible to reach for a huge percentage of the people in the state. But this is going to be more comprehensive. This is going to be contiguous states. It's going to be a real problem. We're going to get to that situation. And I think people predicted it when Kavanaugh was nominated, that in 5 years, abortion will all be, you know, at the very least in 25, 30 states across the country, it'll be illegal. And this will effectively make it illegal insofar as the requirements that the states will have will make it practically, from a practical standpoint, impossible to get an abortion in those states. And we should know within a day or two whether the Supreme Court, how they react to this. If they say to the Fifth Circuit, no, send it back. You did this wrong. We've already ruled on this. Then it's alive for another, you know, who knows. But if they don't, there's going to be 25 states within a matter of months, probably 20 states within a matter of months that will pass similar legislation, and abortion clinics will be basically impossible in these states. So
that's terrifying.
It's terrifying, and it's like it, you know, it's like watching a slow motion train wreck. The moment Donald Trump won that election, it was all but assured, right? I mean, you know, maybe a meteorite hits the Supreme Court, or, you know, knocks out people. But this is the reality. And we'll know in a couple of days about this, at least this threat. And I don't know. Maybe Kavanaugh, Gorsuch will be like, or Roberts will say, I don't feel comfortable overturning precedent that is 2 years old. But when they don't really have to say anything, they just have to sort of turn their eyes away and look away a little bit. Very dangerous stuff.
Things are going to get pretty crazy, I think.
The next 2 years are going to be pretty nasty stuff. It could be nasty well past that, but I guarantee you the next 2 years are going to be difficult.
You know, everyone made fun of the women's strike for being sort of a cute, imminently forming thing that's not a real strike, but like we might have to do a real one, and I'm glad people are starting to wake those muscles up again because we're going to need them.
It's certainly happening amongst the teachers across the country. I mean, there was a vote apparently taken last night in West Virginia to go do a one-day work stoppage. And this West Virginia is where a lot of these teacher strikes in this round started. And the fact that they're willing to go and do it again, they're not playing. And
not to mention all the airport workers.
The airport, we talked about that yesterday. It was when the airline attendants basically just said, "Look what's happening with the air traffic controllers. We're next." That was a not so veiled threat, and yep. It worked. It took 2 hours essentially for that to happen. Lastly, before we go into the fun half, there's still a couple of days left. I don't know the specific day. I think there's at least like a week left. Let's play this clip of Naomi Collins, because this is captures some of the reason why I think she's a good choice for public advocate in New York City. And, you know, the fact is that she is the one candidate in the race who I think is the most alienated from the political establishment in New York. I don't think she's particularly liked by a lot of those players. And that's why I actually think she's perfect for this role. She's the only one who's not taking any real estate developer money. Anybody who knows New York city politics knows that it is real estate money that is the most corrupting force and problematic force within New York City. And here she is. This was at a candidate forum, I believe, making that case.
It's not enough to be progressive on 90% of the issues. It's that 10% of the issues that determines whether somebody has been illegally evicted from the neighborhood that they grew up in. It determines whether or not a council member sides with rezoning their neighborhood. It determines whether or not these oligarchs who are buying up our apartments around the city are paying taxes or not. Why is it we're able to give them tax breaks, but we don't have the money to build affordable housing? We are in crisis. We need to take this seriously. And as public advocate, I am not only not taking any form of developer money, whether through loopholes or not, but I am taking them on directly, investigating them, and I'm investigating city agencies, or like the MTA, where we have a real estate developer sitting on the MTA, or NYCHA that's having closed-door meetings because they're owned by developers. We have to start understanding that these two work hand in hand. The developers in the city are making our city inequitable, and they're driving out all from middle class, higher middle class, to low income in this city, making it completely unaffordable.
All right. And look, if you're a New York City resident, every dollar you give will be matched by $8 by New York City because of their matching funds. If Naomi raises, I think there's another $10,000 to $15,000 she has to cross in terms of the threshold. It's not a lot of money unless you start contemplating the idea that it's not a lot of money for a political race. But at $100 or $50 or $25 or $10 a click, it's going to take a little bit of an effort. So no pitch for the show membership today. We're going to put a link to Nomiki's Act Blue. Head over there if you're a New York City resident. And you can donate money to her, and that's great. But a New York City resident, you donate 10, you're giving her 80. You donate 250, you're giving her, I can't even do the math on that. What is that, like 2,000? So, and it's only up to 250 that gets matched. So head over there, help her out today. We have a link at majority.fm. What is it? Just, you go to Act Blue too, right? I'm sure. And look up, Nomiki Konst, K-O-N-S-T. And we'll put that on their, on the website. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Of course, you can go to Join the Majority Report and check it out. There is no TMBS tonight. It is Thursday.
Bill Fletcher Jr.
Bill Fletcher Jr. will be on the program. And I suspect it's going to have to change next week, too, because we're going to do the State of the Union on Tuesday. Next Tuesday, unless
probably, yep.
Unless Nancy says you can't come again to him.
Be nice.
It would be nice. I'm sort of hoping maybe that could be pushed to like April. Jamie, any antifada this week?
Oh, yes. So we still have up our History is a Weapon from last week, where Sean and Matt Chrisman from Chapa Trap House talk about why the U.S. never had a real labor-backed socialist political party. And tomorrow we're releasing a new episode that we did with Leslie Lee III from the great podcast Struggle Session, where we finally talk about The Handmaid's Tale and other more effective resistance art like The First Purge.
The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
The book or the show?
The TV show and what it means to the
hiatus.
People who love it. Yeah, I know. Well, you know, there's a slightly longer news cycle when you have a podcast
your
when
marketing
you talk about culture.
Your marketing department would have said, wait, you want to peg that to the return.
They're not going
to
get aggregated like that.
Oh, well, maybe we'll talk about it some more. I think we're done with it, actually. We've watched it. We've seen enough.
Well, you're not going to see the new season?
Eh.
Oh, all right.
Maybe if there's some compelling new stuff in there, we'll have to talk about it some more.
We're going to have to do a marketing seminar on the Majority Report retreat.
Please.
Yeah, so speaking of the zeitgeist, literary hangover, we're doing The House of the Seven Gables, released 1851. Check that out. Also,
it's coming back.
I think it's very a timely novel, actually, and I'm not being facetious about that. Also, a TMBS live show Friday night. If you are in the area, you should come to that at the Bell House. Check it out.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920, heading to the fun half.